All lines are now bridged.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Conditions and Maintenance of Certification Requirements Task Force. This is now our third meeting this week, so we are pushing through at a rapid pace here. We will call the meeting to order, starting with roll call. Denise Webb?
Present.
Raj Ratwani?
Here.
Carolyn Peterson?
Here.
Ken, I believe, is still on vacation. Sasha Termont?
Here.
Les Leonard? And John Travis, I believe, is going to be a little bit late. So with that, I will turn it over. I'll turn it over to Kate for just another quick review of the charge, and then we'll jump into discussions around attestations.
Sure. Thanks, Lauren. So the Conditions and Certification Task Force, we're charged with providing recommendations on the conditions and maintenance of certification requirements, including the application programming interfaces, real-world testing, and attestations. The updates to the 2015 edition certification criteria, modifications to the ONC Health IT certification program, and deregulatory actions related to the certification criteria and program requirements.
Thank you, Kate. So let's go to the next slide. So we're going to spend the first few minutes. We're going to try to get this wrapped up in about less than 10 minutes to talk about attestation. And that is the regulatory part 170.406. So under the condition of certification regarding attestations, the health IT developer will initially have to certify that they are in compliance with all the conditions and maintenance of certification that are provided within the regulation, except the EHR reporting criteria submission, which is going to be addressed at a later date. And in this requirement, health IT developers are going to have to submit their attestations every 6 months or semi-annually as a part of maintenance of certification. And in the preamble, it does provide that there's going to be a process to support this. That ONC would publicize and prompt developers to complete their attestation, that they would provide a method for them to indicate their compliance, and they would also provide health IT developers the flexibility to specify non-compliance with any particular certified health IT module if necessary. So I'll open it up to the group to make any comments or concerns or particular recommendations regarding these attestations.
So this is a question.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
This is Sasha. So there's language that says there's a 14-day attestation period. And I wasn't entirely sure what that meant. Is that just the sort of window during which paperwork could be submitted? It seems quite specific to specify that paperwork has to be submitted in that 14 days instead of just saying, like, there's a deadline.
Kate, do you have any clarification on that?
Sure. So there's 14 days for the submission of the attestations. The question was why it's not like a specific date as opposed.
What is the 14-day attestation period? Are you saying that it would be impossible to submit your attestation earlier than that, and then it has to happen within that 14-day period?
I'll have to double check with the drafter on that section, but and I can get back to you. Let me see.
I guess my thinking would be it seems like ONC could set an end deadline, but that the process and timeline for collection of that data could be left to the ACBs that are collecting it from developers, and saying it has to happen in a certain 14 days seems awfully prescriptive and kind of unnecessary.
Yeah, I mean,
right. So
this is Carolyn.
Let's note that. Was somebody trying to speak?
Yeah, this is Carolyn. I was just going to say, if you specify a specific 14-day period, then you put yourself in the position of having to issue changes and extensions and whatnot when you have natural disaster issues, hurricanes, massive tornadoes, Snowmageddons. It seems like the NIH goes through this constantly, where they have to change deadlines for grants because weather events prevented people from being able to file. You would create a lot more hassle for yourself if you get extremely prescriptive, like a 14-day period.
Yeah, that does seem to make sense. It seems better that they set a deadline in the middle of the year and the end of the year, and then by that deadline, those attestations have to be submitted. And then that gives some flexibility for, like Sasha said, for the certifying body to work with the developer, get those in. Okay, so Kate, you have that noted?
Yep.
Yep.
Okay, and then if you follow up with us to kind of what was intended in that 14-day attestation period, why 14 days and not just a twice annual deadline. Okay, any other comments on attestations? And we'll, if not, we can move along. All right, so let's dive into the APIs. And we'll start with, if we could go, yeah, the next slide. So the first is related to changes in certification criteria. And this just specifies that that the rule is proposing to adopt a new API criterion in 170.315G10, and this would replace the application access data category request certification criteria that was in the same area, G8. This new criterion would require use of Health Level 7 fire standards, and then there are some various implementation specifications discussed and included. As part of this discussion, there is a part of the preamble that asks us to look at four options in terms of what release we would recommend. The rule is proposing the fire release version 2, and that this API, there are two types of services that will be enabled through this API criterion, and that's services for a single patient's data and services for multiple patients' data. So there's quite an extensive section in the preamble that discusses the details of all of this. So what I thought we might do is start with whether there's any concerns related to, I think if you'll move to the next slide, Kate, I think this has more explanation. Section 404 of Part 170, it talks about the various roles and definitions and the goals of this regulatory text around transparency, permitted fees, and pro-competitiveness. So there's, like I had said in the preamble, there's quite a bit of extensive discussion around these areas. And so if we could kind of step through those and start with the role and the definitions around the roles, and then we can go through the areas related to transparency, permitted fees, and pro-competitiveness.
Denise, are we coming back to the question of single patient case and multiple patient case? Or I know that was on the previous slide. I just didn't know if we were going to discuss that now or later.
Yeah, let's go back to the previous slide and let's talk about that, because that's really the updates to the certification criteria reflect those two conditions. So if we can move back to the previous slide.
And then I'm just searching, sorry, for the correct page.
Yes, this is first mentioned in, I've got my pages marked here.
101, I think.
It's mentioned on 101, and then it refers us to Section 74, where all the detailed preamble is.
Okay. I'm scrolling further to 7. Does anyone have a page reference for when the preamble of Part 7 starts?
Okay, I'll give it to you. It's 204.
Thank you.
Excuse me, 203, bottom of the page. Do you have a specific comment or suggestion related to the two types of API-enabled services?
The one thing that I guess is notable about the multiple patient data request is that there's not a standard way to do that. So while most of what's being proposed related to API programming interfaces is very focused on identifying a standard way that it would be done across all different products that would be certified, the multiple patient data, there is not sort of an existing standard approach for doing that, and it is included without that. That seemed unusual to me, I guess, in the scope of everything else that's proposed and potentially meriting conversation.
So do we have, a specific suggestion or recommendation that our group, our task force might make related to the multiple patients' data? Are you suggesting that possibly that be deferred until there is a standard that could be applied across the board?
Well, I understand it's an important use case that people are interested in, but I guess I do question if it's appropriate to spend time implementing it in non-standard ways, or if it would be a better investment of the industry's time to develop a standard approach and then implement it at a later date.
Okay. Any comments on that from the rest of the group? Raj, Carolyn? I see John's on.
This is Carolyn. That strikes me. The statement that Sasha made strikes me as something that seems reasonable on its face. But then when I think about the long history of inability to agree upon standards and new standards proliferating with new products, it kind of feels like we're going to still be in the same place we've been for a long time that hasn't always been helpful or meaningful for users. I'm just trying to think of how, if we go with that approach, then we're left with how do we get to the point down the road where we can all adopt it, and how long does that take, and what is all of the regulatory stuff around doing that? It just kind of feels like we're kicking the can down the road.
Well, Carolyn, I certainly respect that it could take time to finalize a standard. I guess what would likely play out if we require it now is that because there is no standard, each developer will implement it differently. And I guess that, unfortunately, makes it harder for, I forget the term, it's on the next slide, but the API users to take advantage of that multiple patient data service because each developer has implemented it in a different way because there was no standard to follow. And so I think if we move forward with it now, we will see everyone investing R&D time into something in non-standard ways, and we'll see it be reduced in its efficacy because of the fact that there was no standard identified. And that might move faster in some ways, right, because it would be available even in a non-standard way. But it would also, I guess, introduce waste in the sense that at some point in the future, we're presumably going to want to move to a standard way to do it to make it more effective and efficient for the API users and for developers to be able to take advantage of, you know, a standard FHIR approach, for example. And if they've already invested in different ways, then the transition could be harder than just investing in the standard way the first place, right? So I guess we have to decide, like, how much value do we get from a non-standard implementation, and is it worth the increased cost of switching later? Or would we be better served by putting the effort that we lose in that switch into faster adoption of a standard method?
Well, again, all of that sounds good, but when I look at the history of how we've gotten down the road, the result feels unsatisfying.
Raj, did you have a comment?
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, I think Sasha's bringing up some really good points, and I think this is a difficult issue that we have to grapple with, but I think, you know, I think the big point is there's an immediate need here, and if we sort of all agree that there's an immediate need, then we need, I sort of think Caroline's making a really good point, which is we're just kicking the can down the road, and we don't really have a great history of executing on these things when we do that.
Right. Well, I'm trying to recall, I thought I had read, maybe I'm confusing this, but on the four options on the different releases for FHIR, that release four could facilitate this. Did I read that wrong? I don't know. Someone who's familiar with the release versions, I mean, it gets pretty technical beyond that point, and then I don't have that expertise.
Hi, this
is a good question.
Go ahead. Hi, yes, we do have a request for comment regarding some different paths regarding either FHIR 2, FHIR 3, or FHIR 4, which recently came out. So maybe that's something that this group can discuss in this conversation as well.
Denise, I think what you brought up is on 232, where they say we expect that FHIR Release 4 will have such specificity.
Yeah, I thought I had read that. Thank you for getting me to that page. Yeah.
I don't know what that means from a technical perspective, if that means, like, we hope it will, or if that means it does.
This is John with Cerner. I joined late. I probably can go back and talk to our API services folks, but I know there's a lot of support here for R4, and we can probably get more substance around that if we want. I can ask them if we're going to get more into that in our next call.
I could ask some colleagues, too, if we want to take a follow-up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we could do a follow-up. Because we were going to try and get through all aspects of the API language in these 2 hours, if possible, including discussing those four options.
Yeah, sorry to kind of come in late, so I'm out of context. I did ask them for a lot of reflections on some of the policy areas that, maybe I provide these after the call, or I can try to offer them in context of the conversation. And they deal more with what are probably some policy matters around some of the proposals or questions that are more functional in nature than technical.
Well, let's put a note on this and keep going, as folks have suggested.
Okay.
Okay. All right, so those were really great points, and thank you for bringing those out. We definitely have, both sides that Carolyn presented and then that Sasha presented. I mean, they're both salient points. All right, so let's move to the next slide. All right, so the preamble is broken up to discuss, actually the first part of it discusses the actual statutory requirements and around standardized, a standardized way, transparency, and pro-competitiveness. And then there's a pretty significant section in here on fees. But before we launch into a discussion around the proposed standards in particular, let's talk about the API technology role and whether there's any suggested changes in those definitions or whether those definitions are clear in terms of who the actors are regarding APIs. Any concerns or comments? All right, I guess hearing silence, I think everybody's pretty good with what those roles intend.
There's probably one thing that kind of fits in, or a couple of things that I think I could throw out there for comment. So these might be more observational than comment, but it could lead to something. The first one is the regime does seem to set up a presumption that the API user, as a developer of an app, is going to be working with and through the API data provider while they need access to the API technology supplier to get things done, if you will, to prove secure connection, to be able to engage in obtaining access to the API services. It seems to presume that invalid may not be the right word, but that there's not a support for the API user and the API technology supplier working together to support development of application offerings without a API data provider being in the mix right away. It seems to rule out, or maybe it doesn't give much treatment to the case of an API user as developer seeking to develop a commercial offering by collaboration with the API technology supplier, and I'm not sure that's true. It certainly shouldn't be ruled out by the way this rule is structured, and it kind of seems to be. So I think that's where all this.
Yeah, or maybe it's just more silent to it. Because I see your point as I read through this. It is permitting the data provider to have the exclusive control over the domain of who connects to get their data, and that they would.
And since we're talking about conditions of certification, maybe that's a presumption. But when we get to the context of the parallel provisions and the exceptions, it's kind of dangerous if it's left that mum, or at least to make explicit statement, it's not considered information blocking or it's out of scope to any conversation here. And I think that would be a fine way to deal with it. And maybe that doesn't belong here, but down in the exception conversation. But at any rate, it would be very helpful to make explicit statements somewhere. Either it's out of scope to the intent of this regulation, or it's a permitted activity that doesn't run afoul of this regulation.
I think that's a point worth noting that we could consider including. I know that a number of the vendors have app stores or app galleries where third parties can work with the vendor to develop an app that works with the health IT technology suppliers' products through an API, and that oftentimes the data provider who eventually is going to provide data is not involved in that development per se until the third party has completed building their application and working in a sandbox environment to ensure it works and interacts with particular for a particular function. But then at the point where, let's say it's a patient app and the patient wants to use that app, they would be interacting with the health system for which they want to obtain their data to bring into that app, I assume. And then that would involve that other API user, the third party that owns the application or is providing that application to the patient, would be interacting again with the data provider at that point.
Yeah, I think that the point is that, and it's kind of true of the current model, that it presupposes the application exists, and the application may have come into existence through no specific involvement. I guess there's a difference between the development activity, which may not require the API data provider's involvement at all, and then, yes, as a practical matter, the API data provider is going to be involved when it comes to the actual I don't want to overuse the term, but white listing for actual production access.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Kate, I think you've probably captured a note on this that maybe we could recommend some more explicit statement of the acceptable relationship or what is expected between an API technology supplier and an API user, that there's multiple relationships that are supported in this environment.
Got
okay.
It. Thank you.
Anything else on key terms? All right. Then the next part of the preamble discusses the actual proposed standard implementation specifications and certification criteria. So this is along the particular FHIR standard release, the proposed adoption of FHIR DSTU 2, standard release 2. That's what they're proposing. And ONC does ask us to contemplate four different options. So this is the next part of the preamble. For the actual standard, option one is what's proposed, release two. Option two is adopt release two and three. Option three is to adopt release two and four, and then option four is to adopt release four. And hopefully you've all had a chance to look at the actual text on that. Can we spend a little time discussing the actual standard and what ONC is proposing versus what we might recommend along the lines of those four different avenues? Or was this something, I know, John and Sasha, that you wanted to do some reach back to your technical folks?
Yeah, I think if the ask is what's the feedback on the major merits of adoption of one versus another, I think that's what we were offering to do by talking to our API services team. I know that we have a general advocacy for our four here, but I would want to get a little more substance from them on why they favor that.
I agree. I think it would be, I'm happy to gather more information from the folks who are in the weeds of the differences between 2, 3, and 4.
Okay. Yeah, because I don't know, Raj, do you have any particular opinion on this, or Carolyn?
I would benefit from further discussion and explanation of some of the technical details.
I would too.
I mean, I'm looking at pages 211 to 213 right now thinking, okay, should I really express an opinion on this? Or I think, for me at least, it would be helpful to know more.
Okay. So if it's okay with the group, why don't we table that? Of course, I don't know who's on from the public. They might have some comments when we do the public comment period. But
can we
all right.
set a date for
yeah.
when we will revisit it so that John and I know when we have to have our follow-up ready? Like, will we discuss tomorrow or next week?
Well, what I'm going to suggest, because when I was looking ahead on the schedule,
mm-hmm.
I think for our meeting, I think we have an hour on Monday, or maybe it's an hour and a half, but when I looked at what we're going to cover, it seems like we could squeeze something in on the agenda there. Would you agree, Kate?
Yeah, and we do. We have an hour and a half on Monday morning.
Oh, okay. So if we could revisit
add that.
Options 1 through 4 for the DSTU standard.
Okay, I'll add that to the Monday's agenda.
Okay, thank you. All right, so this puts us, and this may apply too as well, since you know we may not have the technical depth to reflect other than on a policy perspective around the actual implementation specifications that are being proposed for adoption, which starts on page 214. They're proposing in the regulatory text an implementation specification that would list a set of base fire resources for health IT modules certified to this standard that will be proposed. And they're proposing API resource collection in health or the ARCH.
Yeah, I think what I'm hearing from our folks is we wonder what the purpose or value of ARCH would be. It's our API services folks' thoughts that it's got a lot of redundancy to the USCDI required data classes for version 1. And that systems are probably already able to define what the correct resources are to match to the USCDI required data classes under version 1. There's something under fire resources that's called medication, and we use a resource called medication statement to expose medications. I think that was probably the underpinnings of what was used to certify for the 2015 edition as it is, as the API resource. So I guess that there's a feeling, at least for us, there's not a lot of purpose or value added by adopting ARCH versus asking vendors to develop the resources that align to the USCDI required data classes under version 1.
Do you think it would be helpful to be consistent, though? I mean, I agree they may not
have
the correct service, but does it seem like there's value if everyone adopts the same service rather than some variation in which med services folks use?
Yeah, I think that's a fair point when you're looking at people harmonizing to a release and version basis versus what we saw with the certification regime so far.
Right.
I think what our comment came from was, for us, having done what we've done, it doesn't provide us much value, and it feels like it would be work to go and do for that sake. But that's a fair point. And I can raise that to them to say, you know, think about it from the standpoint, does that cause us any issue from an interoperability standpoint if we were not to move to that? That's a good way to phrase it back to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, it does show here in ARCH's first version, it does show medication statement at the bottom of page 215 as one of
It has medication, medication order, and medication statement.
Mm-hmm.
My take is that conceptually, I think it is useful to interoperability to specify the resources that are expected and the implementation guides that should be followed. For specific details on, hey, there's a problem with this implementation guide or something along those lines, I'll have to come back with some input from our fire team.
Yeah. And it's specifying three implementation specifications or guides that would be followed here. This was the first one. The second one was around the Argonaut Data Query Implementation Guide version 1. And the third is around the specific portion of the Argonaut Implementation Guide referring to the Data Query Implementation Guide server conformance requirements. I mean, generally speaking, I think having specific implementation guides specified does assure that everybody's all on the same page. I mean, I know when I was in public health, I experienced the situation where there were different versions of implementation guides, and that really, and different entities were using different guides, that really created a lot of issues. So, I would recommend that this go forth with specified guidance for implementation. Raj, do you have anything to add?
No, I do not at this time.
Okay, and then the last, I think this is the last part of the criteria, is around adoption of standards and implementation specifications to support persistent user authentication and app authorization. And that starts on page 220, and it speaks around the smart guide specifications and the use of refresh tokens. Are there any comments or concerns in that area?
So I have a technical concern or, I guess, question for the group. When you have a persistent refresh token, the best practice, which is included in the smart implementation guide, would be to only provide a token that allows persistent access to an application that's capable of keeping a secret, right? I mean, if you're providing a secret token to an application that has no security, then you're opening up persistent vulnerability because that application can't guard the secret, as it should be protected. So I'm just trying to puzzle through here. There's no process for, which we haven't gotten to yet, vetting the security of an app that would be provided this token, at least not that I'm seeing. But it would seem to be best practice in implementing the smart implementation guide to say, I'll only provide this token if the app can guard it securely. So how would that be handled?
That's a good question.
It seems that there needs to be a provision for either prior to providing a token, ensuring that the app can keep a secret, right? It's technically capable that way. But that's not really sort of provided for in the current process.
Well, I can say, having been a CIO a number of times, I certainly support that. So we could make a recommendation along the lines that this is specifically addressed as a legitimate and expected activity in implementing the smart guide that to protect patients' data.
Okay.
That we should be clear that this is something that we'd expect the health IT developers to do so that when the data provider
Right, or if it's
actually,
something the data provider does, I guess maybe we need clarity. Like if the technology supplier is doing it, then the process has to accommodate them knowing that the app can keep a secret or can't keep a secret, and how would they know that? An attestation from the API user, some sort of third-party validation, other methods, or if the API technology supplier is not supposed to play that role, would the API data provider play the role of saying, oh, this app is capable of keeping a secret or not? How would they make the determination?
Okay. Thanks, Sasha. That's a good catch. Okay, I think that is, I believe, the last part of this. Now, I guess there's more here. There's a lot of technical stuff in here. So page 226 through, let's see, 232 is actually looking for any specific comments we would have on the proposals related to data response, search support, app registration, and secure connection authentication and authorization.
So data response is on 227 and simply says that any data elements that are mandatory would have to be returned in certification testing. Right?
Yes.
Generally, that seems reasonable from my perspective. I guess the tricky part could be if there are any mandatory data elements that would not be commonly available within EHRs, and we could ask that of some of the fire experts to flag any concerning areas.
I think, though, initially, isn't this being constrained by the USCDI? While ONC acknowledged that the Cures Act expects that any data that's in the EHR would be made available, aren't we initially constraining to the USCDI version 1?
For this, we are. I guess my point, and maybe I didn't articulate it well, if let's say there's a new data element that's part of the, I don't know, patient goals fire service that says the exact time that the goal was made is mandatory. And previously, folks had only captured the day the goal had been made. And then making it mandatory here would have other implications for capturing the time the goal was made in the EHR beyond just delivering it in the fire service. If all the data is in the EHR, I think testing it in the fire service process seems reasonable from my perspective. John, would you agree?
I would agree, and actually I think what you trigger is a different and maybe out of scope of this particular conversation and more one for some other things, but the USCDI does grow and we will get into that situation. And I have to be honest, and maybe I'm just being dense, I'm not quite sure what that does to when version 2 is adopted and they begin to incorporate more administrative and other demographic data that's not a current requirement. I think that really comes into play, Sasha. And I don't know that I see what exactly is growth path for what the vendor is to do from a certification standpoint with the USCDI, which after all itself is a standard, really, as a whole, and then certainly in part. As it grows and they adopt version 2, exactly what is expected and exactly how those things go and get expressed and, you know, how what we see in the current proposal governs that. And let me give you a particular example. And this may be just, again, my own thickness of mind, but we have the ability to adopt higher levels of versions of standard. I don't know that the USCDI itself is exposed to that, but I'm not sure they explicitly say it isn't. But it certainly can add in new data elements that will bring in both new nomenclature standards and potentially imply new resource requirements for the API services. And I think what you mentioned is it's going to happen. It'll be new requirements. I'm just not certain I understand how we are to go about their incorporation and how we proliferate the impact of that out to all the interoperability standards, and including to API.
John, I think that probably the discussion on the USCDI is out of scope of our task force because there is another task force.
Okay, and that's fair.
Specifically,
I bring it up in the context of it will introduce new requirements here, to Sasha's point, that are going to be exactly of that kind, but they are going to be net new. I can't sit here and say that the existing requirement imposes things that aren't already captured in the EHR or aren't already things that would have to be otherwise enabled to be captured because the USCDI requirement applies across modalities of interoperability, if you will. So the point on the patient goal is going to be as much an issue for CDA-based interoperability as it is going to be for API.
Right, right. So I think they're going to have to address some of these points in the USCDI task force and hopefully our ONC team, if that isn't brought up, they could push that over to that group.
Yeah, I didn't mean to get off topic. It's a nested or interrelated.
Okay, so let's move on and see if we can get through the rest of these certification requirements. Anything on search support?
Search support brings up the same no standard for multiple patients question that we talked about earlier. So we can touch on that again maybe after we followed up.
Okay. All right. And then app registration.
Yeah, that one gets into a few things. We're assuming the health system has the real and sole authority to approve use of an application, and is that clearly enough stated? And while dynamic registration is not automatically called out, is that anything to raise as a requirement?
John, I guess I had a different understanding because I did not think that the API data provider was making a decision about patient applications.
Yeah, I think that, maybe that needs to be expressed as provider and patient. No, I think, and maybe I need to reread it because I'm trying to have several things open, but doesn't it state that there is a process of, I try to be careful with the terms, and registration to me even is a bit of a loaded term. There certainly is a process of proving out secure connection and the ability to state compliance to a given API technology supplier's terms and conditions, and then there is a process by which the health system assent, let me use that term, to the use of that application in their environment, and I thought that was generally true as kind of the rough description of the process.
That would be good to clarify because my understanding was that there should not be a step for patient apps.
It's not a vet. I mean, I'm trying to be real careful how I say it, not to use the vetting word.
Right.
There is a general proof point of being able to show that secure connection can be achieved. And I was going to look in the root, probably don't have time to do it, but I thought that there still was a, on the part of the data provider, to be able to have an acceptance step, if you will, that an application was able to be used to access their production domain. And I don't know that I'm careful about my terms. I'm probably describing it more for what the action is than the label used. I'm very careful not to say, I think it's clear there's not really a prior vetting step, if you will, not by the API technology supplier, necessarily, but there still is a step that focuses on assuring that there's not a security risk by the introduction of the application, that the API data provider has the ability to exercise. And whatever you want to specify.
At the end of the section, it does say that ONC believes the discretion that's provided is warranted as API technology supplier and API data providers are best poised to innovate and execute various methods for app registration within a clinical environment. I mean, so they're not being specifically prescriptive of how this is done while they thought about proposing.
I think that's true with respect to the registration process in particular, and I think that challenges that John and I are articulating are not necessarily specific to what they describe about app registration on 228, but are more about the overall process of where app registration would feature in some of the conversation that happens in the 240s as far as pages. And maybe I'm confused too. I guess I'm trying to map out like what would be the process for an app to kind of go from I've made this app based on the publicly available documentation. Then the app needs to register, right? Because that's the next step, and that's why we're talking about app registration. And there's a permitted time period to verify the identity of the registering organization or user, but not to vet the app, right, on the part of the technology supplier.
Really and, careful. Yeah, exactly.
And then after that, I didn't see, and I guess maybe this is the part that John and I are debating, I thought based on the provision of endpoints by the API data providers, which is also required, that the app would then effectively be live. I didn't see a step where the API data provider could approve the app or take other steps, and maybe that's what I'm missing and need to reread.
Yeah, let me see if I can.
I mean, I don't think there is a process about approving the app. The regulation or the proposed rule makes it quite clear that data providers are not supposed to get into vetting what apps, that a patient chooses to use. And if the technology supplier, API technology supplier verifies that the entity providing the app is not some malicious third world country, that they must register and allow connection. We talked about this quite a bit in the Karen Alliance, that it's not the role of the health system to be the guardian of what a patient chooses to do and where a patient chooses to send their data. However, it is important to provide sufficient education and information to patients so that they understand the risks that may exist, but not to prevent them from using whatever app they want to use.
Well, I read the statement again that I think you just mentioned on 229. And I'm really trying to describe in practical terms what that is saying. And that's probably where I'm picking that up, that again, really trying to, and they asked for comment on the perspective. So, again, we don't intend to test registration capabilities, understood, that would be executed within an API data provider's clinical environment. What we're really talking about is making a application available and probably, for its first instance of use to access a given data provider's clinical environment. Once that's done, there's no question. It's there. It's available. If anybody were to present with it, it would be able to be used without any such step. But it's to that first instance of access as a novel thing to a given API data provider's clinical environment. And then they say the discretion is warranted. And I reflect on statements that CMS had made, and I want to say it accrued back to one of the promoting interoperability rule making preamble discussions in either the 2019 APPS rule or in the 2019 macro QPP rule, they made a point similar, and I'm just trying to reconcile all that.
Yeah.
So, John, what I found in Sasha, can I suggest, because we have a lot of material to cover, can I suggest that if you want to come back with a specific recommendation for our task force as a group to consider, why don't we do that? Maybe enter it in on the Google Doc.
Sure.
Because I just don't think we have the time to deliberate.
No, that's fine.
And this is Carolyn. I just had one thought listening to you all and rereading this text. Back at the bottom of 228, it starts out, while requiring dynamic registration could create a more consistent registration experience for health IT developers. What if we make a comment that gets to how this process should be, ONC should be doing things to facilitate the greater adoption of that to create this more consistent registration experience? Because it seems that perhaps rather than arguing about the nitty-gritty details on 229, we could be encouraging development and adoption of the process to get people where we want to be.
I think we certainly support advancing standards like dynamic registration, Caroline. I guess it's not a standard that's widely ready for adoption today, so we do need to figure out the details on 229 for the timely implementation of the features that everyone is planning.
But can we also encourage work on dynamic registration so that we can eventually be there?
I'm not confident that dynamic registration solves the problems on 229 that we're discussing, but I would certainly support advancing the standard.
I think that would be a worthwhile point in making, Carolyn. All right, so this moves us to the last part on secure connection authentication and authorization that's being proposed in the regulation text is saying that the health IT presented for testing and certification must be capable of demonstrating support of user authentication according to OpenID Connect Core 1.0, incorporating the errata set as well. And it does talk about testing in two modes, standalone launch and EHR launch. So are there any specific suggestions or comments related to this? It also does talk about the three-month expiration period for the token.
Yeah, I still have the token question raised earlier, but otherwise I think the testing that's described seems reasonable.
Okay. Are there any thoughts about whether ONC should specify a reasonable upper bound from a timing perspective on when users should be required to reauthenticate or reauthorize?
Like at least 1 year or something?
Yeah, they gave an example of 1 year. I mean, does anybody have any specific druthers around that? I mean, I know as a patient, I oftentimes find if I use an app regularly, I don't see why I have to reauthenticate and reauthorize once a year. I mean, I guess if I don't use it, then the token I suppose would expire then, and I would be having to reauthorize. But I don't know.
Well, the app could potentially be renewing the token even if you weren't using the app,
mm-hmm.
depending on the app architecture, I guess. But if it was completely expired after, say, a year, then even if you weren't using the app, it couldn't still be like pulling your data without you re-authenticating for the EHR.
Mm-hmm.
my sense is that API data providers, and maybe Denise, you have a perspective as a CIO responsible for an EHR database, would want to try to balance the risks that's associated with persistent access by an unknown application to the database with the patient convenience that's offered by less frequent reauthentication.
Well, I know in my previous role that I just left, we didn't require patients to reauthenticate on an annual basis. Their credentials did not expire. Raj, do you have any comment on that?
No, I don't. I mean, I think I don't have enough insight to say whether a year is appropriate or not.
All right, maybe we should leave that to the broader public to make a comment on. All right, so that takes us to the end of all of the particulars related to standards and specifications. And now we would launch into the portion around transparency through the publication of API documentation. So on pages 232 all the way through to where this ends, this section is not large because then it gets into fees. Looks like it's 240. Do I have that right? No, excuse me, 244. So any recommendations around the requirements for the API technology suppliers making their documentation available and the timeframes and the methods in which they must make this documentation available?
I don't have any comments on 232 through 236. I'm not seeing the time frame piece. Is that on one of the later pages?
No, I thought there was. I may be confusing this. Maybe this one didn't have a time frame.
Right. So I'm...
Oh, no, there was a time frame on 240 related to compliance date of 6 months from the final rules effective date to revise their existing API documentation to come into compliance with the final rule.
So just so I understand that, because the actual development to create some of the new APIs that are required is not 6 months, right? So I'm assuming that the documentation updates would be to reflect some of the changes around, like, not requiring a click-through agreement or something. What would be
mm-hmm.
different after 6 months since the new APIs might still be being developed?
Yeah, because this is referring specifically to existing API documentation come into compliance with the final rule. It might be worth noting that the 6 months might conflict with the 24 months.
Right.
To deploy it in production, because how can you revise your existing API documentation when you're in the process of doing development to come into compliance? We might recommend that they look at this date or this time period.
Yeah,
make,
I guess, or clarify what happens in 6 months and what happens in 24.
Yeah. All right, anything else on documentation, transparency? If not, then we'll get into the meaty discussion of permitted fees.
Don't we next have Denise just scrolling through the verifying authenticity?
Oh, yeah, the five-day process.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were seeking comments. We already talked about dynamic registration. You're correct. On page 243, whether
I think it starts on 241.
The bottom of 241. So, you know, I was curious whether the health IT vendor community, what your thoughts were on the five business day process, because I know that does not seem like a very long time. You have to have dedicated resources to be doing that work.
I had several questions, I guess, and I don't, maybe they would feed into some suggestions. First, ONC is clear that API technology suppliers are not obligated to verify identity. And I guess that left open a question for me to say, if no one verifies identity because there's no obligation to do that, can it be clarified that choosing not to verify identity removes liability for a bad actor? I mean, if the five-day business process seems onerous, right, like, gosh, not really a lot of time to effectively verify someone's identity, how do I know if this person is who they say they are or not in a process that has to be executed in a very short amount of time? Then if I choose not to do that and to let them proceed based on who they say they are, can I be excused from consequences that might emerge from someone not being who they said they were? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So I think one of the questions is the sort of liability that comes out of this. If there's no responsibility for performing this authentication process, I think that helps. If the authentication process has to happen, I guess I struggle to know how would it effectively happen with high confidence at all, I guess, much less in a very short period of time.
All right. Others, do you have any thoughts? I mean, it does note that if you chose not to have to vet an app developer,
right,
which is at the bottom of 43, apps still don't have carte blanche access to the healthcare provider's data.
Right. Someone would have to choose to use it, right? A particular patient or if it was going to be enabled in the clinical setting, like a particular user of the EHR, presumably.
Yeah. And they are able to have their access activated if there is any anomalous or malicious behavior.
Correct.
And that, again, is I'm not trying to overread our prior discussion. And, Sasha, I'll send you something. And
sure.
And I'm really trying to pick my word carefully, but I'm trying to find the most nominal, minimal word that says the API data provider has said it's fine for an application that's new to my experience to access my production environment. And I just wondered if that's part of what is expected to go on in the 5 days. I think so. And
I didn't
it's
think
part
it was.
Of what maybe... Well, the 5 days, I think, is that, you know, that an app, someone's presented to the API technology supplier and you've got that time period to, and they've passed all your tests, you've got that time period to make that application, whatever's the right term, that application has met your tests.
In production,
the team.
They can make production connection to the API.
I don't think
exactly.
There are tests, though. Are there, John? I don't see the opportunity for the API technology supplier to conduct any tests. I thought that
no, you're not vetting.
Up.
I'm trying to stay away from the vetting word. It's not vetting. It's by whatever means they. I think the 5 days is the time period you have that once they've done what's necessary to be able to have to comply with your terms and conditions and have a production connection, you have to make it available or sustain a connection to any production.
And you're not verifying, validating their app. You're validating
Right. But within that, and these are the two things that I'll share, there's two statements made, and one of them was in the 2019 IPPS rule. That, and this was with the consumer, when the world was the consumer app of my choice. The statement reads as follows, and I don't want to slow us down, but it ties in, I think, to what we're talking about here, that it was not our intent to imply hospitals and their technology suppliers would not be permitted to take reasonable steps to protect privacy and security of their patients' information. Now, they actually use the vetting word, but even in cases where a healthcare provider or a cert developer chooses not to vet app developers, very much echoing the word here, any it's exactly the same wording as is used here. But it was done in the context of saying, we weren't saying that you're not going to take any reasonable steps. And I guess I'm trying to roll that all up into there's a discretionary action that ultimately is a literal statement in a way that the API data provider is going, I'm good with this application making connection to my production environment. That's really all I'm trying to say. That it's not vetting.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's ruled out by anything I've seen. You don't have to do it, but nor is it telling you you can't do it. And that's really all I'm trying to say. And so what's funny is the quote I have is exactly what's said at the bottom of page 243 and top of 244. However, it first appeared in the CMS rule in the 2019 IPPS final rule in a context of consumer access. So they're reusing something here that was used in that context.
All right. So.
And that's all
I don't think we're going to solve this debate about this now. Do we want to just put forth a specific comment or recommendation?
Could we request that if there is clarity on this and John and I are just not finding the right references, maybe someone from ONC could point us to the right parts at a future call and we could review? Or if there's not clarity, I think then maybe our comment as a task force is that we think it needs to be clarified.
I would go with that. And what I can do, Sasha, I'll copy. There's no reason not to copy other people. What I'll do is take the statement from the 2019 IPPS rule, take the statement made on the bottom of page 229, and take this statement, which you'll see when you see it, almost as verbatim, lift from the 2019 IPPS rule. And I'm just simply saying, does that say that there is some simple exercise of discretion by the API data provider to say, I'm good with this now having production access to my environment? It has nothing to do with the API technology supplier other than it's met all the tests of proving production connection or being able to be compliant with the API technology supplier. It's not vetting. It's exactly what's there. But then is there a discretionary act? Because I feel like CMS and ONC have not been quite on the same page, and now they're kind of trying to be. But I don't know quite what they're trying to say. So sorry to be dense, but yeah.
Well, my understanding from the discussion on this is that a health system could not put up any barriers. I mean, this is coming from OCR. To patients using the app of their choice to get their data, unless that app is going to put their health technology infrastructure at security risk, or that it's malicious in some respect. So I think they were pretty clear that a health system could deny an app access if it operated in a malicious way that would bring harm to the health system security infrastructure that protects the EHI from you know, not from the patient getting their data, but from others that are not entitled to that data. So
what is really interesting, and I'll drop it, and I apologize for being such a stick in the mud, but
well,
in
we'll
the 2019 ICPS quote, yeah, just the last thing, what's really interesting, and I'll speak to it, in the IPPS rule quote, CMS makes a statement, such measures might include vetting application developers prior to allowing their apps to connect to the API functionality of the provider's health IT. In the quote in the ONC rule here, they drop that statement.
Okay. All right. Well,
so,
we probably
yeah,
just need to request clarification. And I like Sasha's idea to have the ONC team, if there's
yeah,
other places you can point us to that will clarify this for us, great. If they can't, then let's go ahead and make a comment, a recommendation. All right. Can we move into fees?
Sure.
All right. There's several pages on fees. The fees section talks about general conditions. What is proposed as what they're proposing as permitted fees, what they're proposing as prohibited, I believe is the next prohibited fees. And that is covered in pages 2, 44 through 262 of the preamble. So do we want to start with just general conditions?
Does that start then on 247, Denise?
Yeah. Yeah, because the introductory portion just discusses that.
Right.
You know, that technology suppliers obviously need to recover their costs and earn a reasonable return, and that regardless of what's decided about fees, there would be no fees for patient-related access to his or her EHI. So on page 247 is the general condition, and there are 1, 2, 3, 4 pieces of regulatory text that are discussed here. The first is around in order that to be a permitted fee, a fee imposed by the supplier must be based on an objective, verifiable criteria and uniformly applied for all substantially similar or similarly situated classes of persons and requests. That would be number one. And number two is the fee imposed must be reasonably related to the cost of supplying and, if applicable, supporting the API technology. To or at the request of the API data provider to whom the fee is charged. Number three is for fee to be permitted, the cost of supplying and, if it's applicable, supporting must be reasonably allocated. So this has to do with allocation across whom this technology is being supplied to or supported. And number four, that in order to be a permitted fee, the fees cannot be based in any part on whether the person requesting access or other person is a competitor, a potential competitor, or will be using API technology in a way that facilitates competition with that supplier. So those are the four provisions in the general.
All
mean, I thought they were fairly specific. Raj, are you still with us?
Denise, if I remember, I do believe he said he had to drop off early in one of our conversations.
Okay. If there aren't any specific recommendations for this area, we could move on to permitted fees. Let's see.
It starts at the top of 250.
Pardon?
It starts at the top of 250.
Yeah. And this is permitted fee for, these are the permitted fees. The first one is around developing, deploying, and upgrading the technology. Any concerns with that? And then the next one is on page 253. It permits fees to recover costs of supporting the usage for purposes other than patient access exchange and use.
So just this is maybe very in the weeds, but would the process of certifying the API be considered as part of the development or as part of the support, or it doesn't matter, but one of the places in there?
You mean with the accrediting body, the actual certification process and the cost of that?
Right, yep.
ONC, can you clarify whether that's considered part of development?
Sure. Stephanie, are you still on? If not, I can follow up.
I am on the line, but I would have to follow up.
We can double check.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you. All right. And then, let's see here. So those are permitted fees. And then the last one is for value-added services. Any comments? All right. How about prohibited fees, which starts on 261? And on 262 is three bulleted items that discuss specific fees that a supplier would be prohibited from charging. And then finally, I would ask, are
one
there
question
any
that I had. Oh,
go ahead, just, Sasha.
Sure. So, and this is maybe back to some of John's questions earlier, but in 262, they make it sound like sandboxes. I guess I'm ambivalent about what the sandbox expectation is. It says it could include access to test environments. If the expectation would be that API data providers would be testing with apps that they wanted to work with, is that then, I guess I'm trying to understand what is actually expected on 262.
Yeah, I'm looking at that as well, Sasha. I think it fits within some of what we were talking about earlier, and it speaks to,
right.
I mean, the notable thing isn't necessarily the fee, it's the activity.
Yes. I guess the fee piece is kind of just where it appears in the section. I guess if someone was making an app that like launched in the middle of your EHR and they wanted to work on that app with a certain health system, maybe like the scenario John described earlier, then my expectation would be that the test environments for that app would be provided by the health system that they were working with. So the API technology supplier would be publishing the documentation that's earlier. They would be making available the APIs for the specifications for the API user and the API functionality for the API data provider. But the testing tools in that case would be provided by the API data provider.
The way they phrase it here, I agree with you. I think it does harken back to the question I raised earlier, and it's just a clarification question whether or not any direct work between the API technology supplier and the API, I'm sorry, the application developer as the API user is at all dealt with this. And this is kind of why I was asking that question, at least in part. But I think for what it's raised here, there's also probably a difference between what is a development activity where, you know, there's this kind of give and take, and that's the purpose of the test environment or the sandbox. It's not, maybe it's not for the same kind of purpose or process that would just simply be a new application connecting to a production domain of an API data provider that's already proven its ability for secure connection and for, you know, meeting the terms and conditions of a developer. So I think there's different purposes there.
Right.
This seems to speak to a developmental activity that is a deliberate engagement between the API data provider and the API user to develop a new application for use that the API data provider may want to make available, or they may be playing both of those roles.
But I think that development, John, is outside of the scope of this. I think when they're speaking about development here and the cost of doing the development, it's specifically around the API technology, not the app
okay. That
you might develop with somebody that accessed the API technology to get to the data. And I think my read of this, like on where they use this example of you cannot charge a fee to access a test environment, but to build that test environment for an API technology,
yeah. That
would be part of the development cost that would be permissible in a charge to recover the cost in the fee you would charge and allocate fairly across all those that would be benefiting from that.
Well,
patients.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't think what I was saying was ruled out either. I'm looking at the second statement in that paragraph, which could entirely be for the purpose of the app developer working with anyone. And we're speaking specifically of being able to access
just the documentation for the API technology. That second bullet is just the documentation for the API to use the API technology in the process of this software developing the app.
I don't think it's speaking to where the development is. I'm not trying to quibble. I'm not sure it is ruling in or out the actors are.
I don't think.
No,
okay,
I mean,
what I read here is they're not trying to prevent business relationships between health IT vendors that may supply the suppliers of API technology. In general, their business dealings and partnering to build an app together that might use the API technology. But I mean, if we need clarification on that, I mean, certainly we can make that recommendation. But I mean, for me personally, I thought this was pretty straightforward.
Yeah, I read it as you did, Denise.
So if there's something specific, John and Sasha, that you would like to recommend to get further clarity, I mean, we as a task force can certainly deliberate on that. All right, I'm watching our time. Looks like the one remaining part I want to mention on page 263, there is a record keeping requirement, and they do ask if they want to align the record keeping with the period of time that was also specified that we discussed, was it yesterday, on record keeping. And I don't know, the one question I would have, because this concerns financials, does it align with the general accounting principles and IRS requirements to align that time frame, you know, the 10-year or the 3-year based on certification, I believe, is what it's referencing on page 264 for duration of record, maintaining record. And do you think we need to get some clarification on that, on whether to make sure this doesn't conflict with GAAP or IRS requirements? Sasha and John, any thoughts?
Was it just, so this is the record keeping that's the general, and it kind of echoes also the record keeping that's more broadly applied to certification.
Yes. I noticed it aligned with the rest of certification as far as the proposal, but I didn't check it against accounting principles.
No, I didn't either. Although the IRS, what is that generally, 7 years?
Yeah. So it's,
and
it's
other CMS requirements are also 7 years for what substantiates a claim. Maybe it's six.
So would that conflict with the, you know, the 3-year provision? Because if you're charging fees for a particular version that is no longer going to be part of certification, then there was the 10-year and the 3-year provision.
I don't think it would conflict. I guess it's possible you would keep records longer for financial reasons, but...
Yeah. Okay. Well, I
didn't take any particular reaction to this. I think that, you know, other things could be said for, you know, articulating which, here the, it's fairly specific on stating which records. I think there's some fuzziness to the statement more generally applied for the 10-year requirement as to which records, but
yeah,
they don't get into a lot of detail there, but that's not here.
Okay, so now this brings us to pro-competitiveness, openness, and pro-competitiveness conditions. And this section discusses, beginning on 264 at the bottom through the end here, up to 272, or actually, no, up to 270, and it covers non-discrimination, rights to access and use API technology. Oh, and then there are some additional obligations. I thought this was pretty straightforward. It does refer back to some areas that are within information blocking, and I did point out to Kate earlier, I think there's a incorrect reference on here. It appears on 268, 269, and again on 271, it references Roman numeral 8, D.3.C, which doesn't exist, and I think they really meant D.6. which covers these same terms in the information blocking section. Any specific concerns?
I'm impressed you
Pardon?
Caught that. I said I'm impressed you caught that was an invalid reference.
Well, I wanted to go see when they said it mirrors or reflects what's in that section. I just wanted to go see if it did, and it didn't. So I was like, oh, this must be the wrong reference. And actually on page 264, where this starts and it says Roman numeral 4, openness and pro-competitive conditions, that should really be Roman numeral 5. because four is permitted fees. So that's another one I caught, Kate.
We're putting you on the annual report committee next year, Denise.
Okay.
Thank you for proving your service.
Well, wait till you see my hard copy. I've got these little color-coded tags all over the place just so I can find things in this huge document.
Oh, my.
All right. We're doing pretty good on time here. It looks like we will get through all of – this is the last area, right, Kate, the pro-competitiveness?
I believe so. Let me just scroll down.
And I know we did
and
this a little different.
And then HR.
The which?
The base EHR.
Oh, yeah, base EHR.
Definition.
Oh, that one's just one small, well, not small provision, but it's just one paragraph. All right, anything on this for the group? If not, we can talk about the changes in the base EHR definition on page 275. And then we can probably go to public comment and then talk about what we're going to do next and wrap up. So base EHR definition, they intend to replace 170.315G8 with G10, which is the FHIR DSTU2 and proposed as release 2. I'm hearing silence.
This seemed to make sense to me, unless there's a flawed reference, which I didn't check as rigorously as you, Denise.
Well, the only thing I noticed, it says that it's going to replace the current criterion, but I noticed in the back of the back where the regulation text is, it doesn't show 8 is now reserved, like it's been replaced, but it doesn't say it was specifically replaced in the way they have this laid out, they talk about what they're changing in the regulation, and then they show you the regulation text. So that was on, just for your reference, Kate, on page 630, it does not say remove and reserved for G8 yet, where you actually see the regulation text. It doesn't exist any longer. Can you confirm, are you proposing that it actually be taken out or that they'll exist together until everybody's on 10?
They will exist together for a period of time, and I can clarify that. So what you're saying here is what we have as replaced, you know, maybe confusing.
It is, because if you look at page 638, it shows 8 as reserved, meaning that it's been replaced. And then 639 goes into the discussion, the new text for 10, G10. So G9 and G10 are the two new, I think 9, 10, and 11. No, 9 stayed the same. 10 and 11 are new. 10 is the standardized API for patient and population services, and 11 is the, I believe, consent management for APIs. Okay, so that...
So I'm just going to point you to the definition section for base EHR, and that's where it's added section 170.315G8 or G10 until 24 months from the final rule's effective date.
Okay. Yeah. So it's an intention to replace that, but not till that date.
Correct.
Okay. So that brings us to the end of the topics that we needed to cover today. And are there any items that we did not talk about in this area of APIs that anybody on the task force would like to bring up?
Not at this point. I think Sasha and I have our homework to do more on exploring pros and cons around the versions of the FHIR standard.
Yep.
And I'm going to send along an email that just kind of states my confusion in support of Sasha's suggestion for clarity on the what to me is, I really feel, kind of almost a cavalier use of terminology of words registration, vetting, and access that
okay.
I'm having my struggle with, and maybe it's just mine. But you'll see why when I send the email.
Okay, yeah. If you'll just copy everybody that's on the meeting appointment with materials that we got, that would be good.
I will.
All right, great. Thanks. And then anything else? So, Lauren, should we go to public comment now, or do you want to?
Yeah, I think we can. We pulled up the phone number just to give folks time to dial in. But, yeah, if there's nothing else, we'll go to public comment. And if we've gotten to other topics, I guess we can break for the day. So with that, operator,
yeah,
can you
–
oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say after public comment, then we can just do a little wrap-up in terms of our next steps and what we're going to be doing in the next meeting.
Sure. Absolutely.
Okay.
Operator, can you open the public line?
Certainly. If you'd like to make a public comment, please press *1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue, and you may press *2 if you'd like to remove your comment from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys.
Okay. And do we have any comments in the queue?
We have none at this time.
Alrighty, I will hand it back over to you, Denise.
All right, so we do have a meeting tomorrow, and we're going to be covering, let's see, is this on the next slide? I think we have a schedule. We can go to the next slide. Okay, so tomorrow we're going to be covering the other updates to the 2015 certification criteria. So we already covered the updates for the API. And so we have these four remaining areas to talk about. So besides looking at the changes in the regulation text, I was going to help you all out by pointing out where this is in the preamble. And it actually starts on, and it's not in this order that's listed on the slide, so not to confuse you, but if you start on page 77. At the bottom of the page, it starts with the electronic prescribing standard and certification criterion, and then it goes through page. Hold on a sec.
Is there a
page 116, I believe.
If we want to put in notes for tomorrow's mm-hmm. meeting, is there like a OneNote we should put, or a OneNote, a Google Doc we should put them into?
Kate, we have the regulation text for API set up in the Google Doc, right?
Yeah.
I know we didn't pull it up today, but.
And then we have, like, the EHI and electronic prescribing and CQMs and stuff in there, too, so we can, like, add comments. And that will certainly facilitate tomorrow's conversation, I imagine.
Yeah, I will. The criteria one is not up yet, but I'll get that up by the end of the day.
And then our meeting, I believe, is tomorrow afternoon, correct?
Right, 3 to 4:30.
Okay. All right. Anything else before we close out our meeting? And I thank everybody for making yourself available.
Thank you for keeping us on task, Denise.
Yep. You're welcome.
Yeah.
There is a lot of material here, and it can get, it can get pretty thorny. All right, so we'll plan on convening tomorrow. We're doing well on our schedule, and I know we have two meetings scheduled next week on Monday and Tuesday, and then hopefully we'll be getting some draft recommendations, comments and recommendations that Kate is putting together for us to review and discuss so we can finalize some draft recommendations to be prepared for the meeting on March 19th in Washington.
Great, thank
you
so much.
So we will like to try to schedule one more meeting, but at least prior to the in-person meeting in Washington to go over those. Just to look ahead.
Sounds good.
Okay. Well, thank you, everyone.
Okay. Thank you.
And I'll dial in for our debrief, Kate, in just a minute here.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.